This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. President Trump's immigration order touches New Hampshire families, schools, and businesses. Former gubernatorial candidate Frank Edelblue will have to wait for his confirmation vote as New Hampshire's education commissioner. Inmates at the Berlin prison boycott meals over a ban on visiting room kisses and hugs that linger. Meanwhile, back at the State House, opposition to decriminalizing marijuana is fading. Welcome. This week, the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers, joined by Jeff Feingold from the New Hampshire Business Review, Ella Nilsson of the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. All right, a lot going on this week. Let's start with President Trump's action on immigration, refugees, an order that indefinitely bars refugees from Syria, a 90-day pause on refugees arriving from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. You know, with no international airport, New Hampshire didn't have some of the scenes we saw playing out elsewhere with people being held up or the protests that happened there. But there are a lot of people in New Hampshire affected by this, aren't there, Ella?
Yeah, so immediately there were 15 refugees from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Burma that were scheduled to start arriving next week in early February to New Hampshire, being resettled in Concord, Nashua, and Manchester. Those are the people that are immediately held up now due to the four-month temporary pause on all refugees being resettled in the United States. But a couple of refugee resettlement groups that I talked to in Concord and Manchester said there are dozens more people in the pipeline that are now being held up as well.
And you know, people who aren't refugees are also being affected.
Right.
You know, we spoke to a doctor, an American citizen who grew up in Iran. His wife, who is from Iran, was, you know, slated to come. She was scheduled for a visa interview this week, and that was canceled because of the order. Why don't we hear from him? This is Dr. Omid Magimi.
I think our only option will be, if it is going to be permanent and there's going to be no recourse for my wife to get here, then we'll have to leave. And we'll have to basically permanently leave and go to another country so that we can live together.
That's Dr. Omid Magimi. He's at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Jeff?
I was going to say that Dr. Magimi's case raises an interesting point because it's not just people who are refugees who are affected by this, but you know, we have industries in the state that are potentially affected. There was a conference the other day, the Bi-State Primary Healthcare Association held a meeting, a breakfast meeting with legislators, and basically one of the major takeaways from that is that we have a severe physician shortage in the state. We've sort of at least 134 physicians, and that's a lot. And most of them are in the North Country. And what we do, what they have been doing and what they're trying to do is recruit physicians from other countries to come here to help alleviate that shortage. And we also know that in the tech industry, we've tried at the Business Review to talk to people in the tech world, but they seem to be a little reticent about it. But they do rely on importing workers, you know, specialized workers to fill jobs that they can't find Americans to fill. So there's this looming issue of what happens. This is a temporary ban, restriction, whatever you want to call it, but if it lingers on past it, and what is the message about America being sent to other countries that aren't necessarily affected by this ban, but they're saying to people, well, you thought you were welcome here, but maybe you're not quite as welcome here.
Yeah, I think, you know, whether you support the underlying concept of the executive order or not, there's pretty broad agreement that it was very, very poorly vetted and implemented with all kinds of unintended consequences around the country. And you've seen a number of states, state attorneys general speak out. You've seen a number of governors around the country speak out. And there's all this very gripping personal anecdotal information out there, stories on the news, the impact it's had on families, on businesses, et cetera, which has been, I think, really mobilizing for people who oppose this. But it's going to take some time to kind of figure out how this all shakes out. And then, you know, what lies down the road in terms of adding, potentially adding additional countries to the list. Right now it's at 7. The Trump administration has talked about possibly adding additional countries on the list in the future. So we'll see. But there's been just been incredibly disruptive. And, you know, some people say, well, this is what Trump promised to do. And he said he was going to be disruptive. And it has been very disruptive. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that the kind of lack of vetting and thinking through the consequences has led to all these unintended outcomes for families.
Well, it has been interesting to look at the political fallout from this and certainly the reaction in New Hampshire. Dean, you mentioned the attorneys general who have opposed this or criticized it. New Hampshire's Attorney General Joe Foster issued a statement joining 16 other attorneys general, and he said specifically that essentially the order violates principles that are fundamental to our democracy. You know, Governor Sununu has been a lot more circumspect in commenting on this. This order, recall, happened, you know, a week ago today. It was issued at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't the fallout didn't become, you know, clear until a little bit later. You know, Governor Sununu didn't comment on this at all, despite repeated requests from the press until, you know, late Monday morning, and he also spoke to reporters about it on Wednesday. Why don't we take a listen to what he said?
It's a very prudent step to take for, again, anyone just coming into office and assessing the system, assessing what the realities are. So, you know, strengthening that vetting process is something that I have talked about in the past. It's a vetting process really out of Washington with the refugees that come to New Hampshire. Governors really have very little say. We get very little information.
Okay, that was Governor Sununu on Wednesday, and you know, that was a little bit more pointed than the written statement he issued. But you know, you can tell he's kind of keeping it a bit at arm's length.
Yeah, I think that's true of a lot of Republicans nationally. They're kind of several have spoken out, but others have not really tried to go to the level of, let's say, Attorney General Foster or even anywhere near that. And I think Governor Sununu at this point is kind of keeping as neutral as possible on this to see where it falls out, and to justifiably so. But also, at another level, you know, the governor is his family is has roots from I believe Palestinian. They're from Palestine, and that does raise other questions about what his eventual response would be if, let's say, this ban includes people from that area of the world.
It's interesting. His initial statement on Monday, as you said, was kind of very brief and essentially said that he would continue to monitor the situation that develops. And then you had this very jarring juxtaposition with his statement and Mayor Ted Gatsis of Manchester, who put out a much more kind of full-throated statement about looking after the interests of refugees. We know Manchester has a large refugee population, large immigrant population. So, you know, here's another another politician who ran for governor in the primary. Did not win. Very different kind of statement than what we saw from Governor Sununu.
Specifically, Mayor Gatsis said that he was, quote, concerned with the haste with which this order was implemented and the resulting chaos and confusion. You know, another player in the governor's race was Manchester's police chief, Nick Willard, who got into a back and forth with Governor Sununu about, you know, how vigorously people on the front lines were dealing with the opioid crisis. And he, Nick Willard, took after Attorney General Foster's comments, and he tweeted, the AG should be apolitical and focus on protecting New Hampshire citizens, not criticizing the president. Law enforcement deserves better at real Donald Trump. And, you know, Chief Willard has been known to make his opinions known, and he certainly uses social media in a way that I'm not sure any other police chief in the state does. You know, what did you make of that, Jeff?
I thought it was seemed a little unusual that you know, he would be criticizing Attorney General Foster for doing what he's doing to Attorney General Foster, basically. It's interesting because I've talked to people who work as reporters in Manchester, and it the chief seems to really enjoy selective use of the press for certain things, and his department is not the most open when it comes to dealing with reporters and giving up information. But when he wants to get something out, he's very, very astute at doing it.
Well, and certainly there was speculation that Chief Willard might be hoping for a position in the Trump administration. There was some talk about him getting some sort of job, in the drug policy, potentially even so-called drug czar. You know, I've heard other people say, well, maybe a U.S. Marshal for New Hampshire. But I can recall on the campaign trail, Donald Trump visited the Manchester police station during shift change at a rally at the Verizon Center. Yeah. He sort of called out, Chief Willard, I forget precisely what he said, but it was complimentary. And so there is some sort of relationship there.
Politics is very interesting, isn't it, Josh?
It is. And another relationship that got a lot of attention this week that is interesting was between the president and former Senator Kelly Ayotte, who's essentially taken a temp job with the administration, acting as Judge Neil Gorsuch's, Senate Sherpa is how it's being described, as he climbs through the confirmation process. What do you make of that, Dean?
It was interesting. I think some people were caught a little bit by surprise. There are sort of differing opinions among Republicans. Judd Gregg, former U.S. Senator from New Hampshire, said that, it's a little bit of fence mending between Ayotte and Trump. It sort of serves a useful purpose for both of them. It keeps Kelly Ayotte in touch kind of with the political process in Washington. She does have a lot of strong relationships in the Senate. She's viewed as being fairly bipartisan. It's good access for the Supreme Court nominee to have her come along. And so it's good for her and for Donald Trump. It obviously gives him an opportunity to get his nominee out there. So Judd Gregg called it fence mending. Al Baldessaro, who's a strong supporter of Donald Trump, said, well, she finally came to her senses. So this is sort of interesting, different ways of looking at it. I think it makes sense for her. I think it makes sense for Trump. It's become this position known as the Supreme Court Sherpa. That's what they call it. There's always somebody appointed to shepherd the nomination through the Senate.
I have to say, it's interesting because if you remember, after he was elected, before he became president, the then president-elect Trump gave an interview to the New York Times, and they asked him specifically, would you give a job to Kelly Ayotte in your administration? He said, no way, never. So it's interesting. It's an interesting point to remember when the president, it's not the president now, makes these statements saying never, whatever.
This is one of those jobs where, Trump is not really going to be sort of directly in the picture most of the time.
No, but it's really he needs her, though.
Needs her. Yeah, but in terms of like the two of them kind of being in sort of an uncomfortable proximity with each other, it's not going to be a primary focus.
Yeah, I don't see her visiting Trump Tower.
No, she'll be in the Senate, yep.
And she's obviously not the first New Hampshire attorney general turned U.S. senator to play this role. Senator Rudman obviously had played a similar role when David Souter was up for confirmation. And so, we'll see what this means for Ayotte. But, it is again, a way that which, she has, regardless of what she decides to do, there's going to be a cooling off period. But this is certainly something that, kind of keeps her out there politically.
Well, and we do hear now, you mentioned David Souter, former U.S. Supreme Court Justice from New Hampshire. He has become sort of the litmus test for conservatives. Is Gorsuch a David Souter or not? Are the other candidates David Souters in the sense of his belief among conservatives when he was put on the court that he would be a lot more conservative than he actually turned out to be? Well, so Souter is sort of now embedded in Supreme Court nomination history as shorthand for somebody who's not as conservative as conservatives wanted. The other famous example is Judge Bork, who was defeated, and they call that being borked. So we have the David Souter and we have being borked.
Well, actually, at the time, the chief of staff to President George Bush the first was Governor Sununu's father, Governor Sununu, I guess, is the way of putting it. And he referred to David Souter as a home run for conservatives. So it came back to haunt him, I guess.
Well, while our former U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte is soon to be back on the Hill, sherping Judge Gorsuch, our current senators, Shaheen and Hassan, are proving to be kind of a tough crowd for some of President Trump's cabinet picks, aren't they, Ella?
Yeah, so the two senators from New Hampshire briefly introduced legislation earlier this week that would have kind of pushed back on the announcement of a federal hiring freeze as it related to the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard and some other military things, and then subsequently learned that the hiring freeze sort of was not related to military things, so the Naval Shipyard was safe. But I think that was introduced after Senator Shaheen said that she had heard from some Naval Shipyard workers that their jobs were going to be cut off or restricted. But certainly the two senators from New Hampshire, including new Senator Maggie Hassan, former governor, are certainly kind of proving to be in the news a lot as it relates to the Trump administration. Last week, Maggie Hassan certainly made a lot of news with the Betsy DeVos nomination, pressing her on the federal law around people with disabilities in public education, and that video was certainly circulating around social media a lot. Now Betsy DeVos is facing a very extremely tight vote in the Senate after two Senate Republicans came out and said they would not support her.
Right now, it would take Mike Pence potentially to break the tie, which apparently has never happened on a confirmation.
Right. No, it's interesting because you could argue that it was Senator Hassan's grilling, I guess, of Ms. DeVos that led to Senator Collins from Maine and Senator Murkowski from Alaska actually coming around to become the two Republicans that have that forcing that. So far, that tie.
And it's now requiring Republicans to not confirm Jeff Sessions yet so that he can vote in favor of DeVos in order to have that 50-50 tie that Pence can then break. Both Governor Hassan, now Senator Hassan, and Senator Shaheen have been very active in the confirmation hearings. They're basically voting no on these candidates. There's a lot of pressure on Democrats to push back against the Trump administration. And I've noticed in particular, Jeanne Shaheen, and we've talked about this in recent weeks, increasingly becoming kind of a spokesperson for the Democratic opposition. I'm seeing her in sort of the media outlets and cable news in a way that I've never seen her before.
Well, her statement on Neil Gorsuch is emblematic of that.
She says,
quote, "I will not support any candidate who intends to turn back the clock on civil rights, including women's reproductive rights and LGBT equality." And so what does that sound like to you? Sort of a real litmus test.
Absolutely. And I have to say, when she spoke at the Women's March and Rally the day after the inaugural, she was very fiery. I mean, I haven't seen her like that in a long, long time, where she was really very just going out after the Trump administration and various fears that she raised about it and concerns. It's interesting that she's kind of like, because she's in a minority now and really has this, it just seems to have motivated her to speak out a little bit more than she always did seem a little bit more, reticent, I guess.
Well, and her statement was a little bit more out there than Senator Hassan's. I mean, Senator Hassan says the first week of the Trump administration underscored the need for a strong and independent judiciary that will serve as a check on the executive branch. You know, I will thoroughly review Judge Gorsuch's record, and essentially, I want to know whether he'll protect the rights of all Americans and how he would evaluate constitutionality of executive orders. And certainly, Gorsuch's record, people are pointing to that he's not always friendly to executive power, and that's obviously going to be a theme that runs.
And that statement, and Senator Hassan's statement, is not signaling to specific opposition groups in the way that Senator Shaheen is with a reference to LGBT, reproductive rights. I mean, those are kind of the groups that are going to organize around the nomination.
And that's the groups, and those are the kind of things she was talking about at the women's rally. It's really interesting that she's really just become kind of a spokesperson for the Senate for those kind of concerns.
Tell us what you think. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The number is 1-800-892-6477, email at exchange@nhpr.org, or reach us at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. We're joined this week by Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, Ellen Nelson, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. We're going to turn to action at the State House after the break. Do stick around. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, this week we're joined by Dean Spillier of Southern New Hampshire University, Ellen Nelson, Concord Monitor, Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review. We're going to turn to the State House now. Lawmakers were busy, and so certainly was the Executive Council. The confirmation hearing of Governor Sununu's pick to lead the Department of Education, former state lawmaker Frank Edelblue. This was obviously a selection that mobilized people, Republicans, conservatives who like Edelblue's stances on school choice. He's a person who homeschooled all seven of his children, and Democrats who see Edelblue as unqualified and insufficiently committed to public schools. Frank Edelblue sought to rebut that. Why don't we take a listen to what he said?
I have no intention of dismantling public education. I do have every intention of helping the system move forward and offer a product that parents, employers, and educators want for our young people.
All right, that was Frank Edelblue at his confirmation hearing. And this hearing was, you know, a bit of a spectacle, frankly. It lasted for 5 hours. The chamber was packed, yellow scarf wearing people symbolizing school choice, anti-Edelblue signs. You had state reps kind of standing at Edelblue's shoulder as he testified. And then you had Counselor Andrew Valinsky, new to the council and, you know, best known as the lead lawyer in the Claremont School funding lawsuit. He really, you know, went after Edelblue courtroom style. And, you know, I've been to many, many state confirmation hearings. This was certainly a new level of intensity. Why don't we listen to Andrew Valinsky of District 2?
You do not have undergraduate academic preparation in an education school or in a program of education. Is
no.
that correct? You do not have graduate academic preparation in an education school or program of education.
Correct.
You've never taught as a public school teacher?
I have taught as a homeschool teacher.
Do you equate being a homeschool teacher with being the teacher in a public school?
I do not.
Thank you.
All right, that was Andrew Valinsky, District 2 Executive Counselor, and Frank Edelblue, Governor Sununu's pick to lead the Department of Education. Sounds a lot like tape out of a courtroom, doesn't it, Jeff?
Yeah, I have to say that it was really did sound like a trial. It reminded me in some ways of why Andy Valinsky, Counselor Valinsky, was so successful in the Claremont suit. I mean, it sounded like a courtroom, and it almost was like one of those, the scene was almost like one of Senate hearings you would see on from the 50s or something, you know, basically grilling this, you know, putting this guy under the light.
Well, he had an easel with a poster on it that said, you know, not qualified to be education commissioner, and then he was
just
running,
down the list.
And this, you know, and he was asked by other counselors to speed things up. He would ask if he would perhaps cede some of his time to some of the many people who were there to testify. And, you know, he said no.
Yeah.
And, you know, he ultimately did get done.
This is the hottest of hot buttons for Counselor Valinsky, obviously, because of his long association with the Claremont case. And I have to say that Mr. Edelblue's nomination, I think in some levels it's on a much smaller scale, but it's like the polarization that happened with the nomination of Betsy DeVos. It really immediately stirred up these two sides to just kind of go after each other and to, you know, one's to obviously protect the nominee and the other to just go after him as much as they could. You know, obviously by the count on the Executive Council, he will be approved. It's had to be delayed because of the governor's office failed to consult with the entire state school board, you know, so a technical thing, but, you know, I'm sure that'll be worked out. But I think that basically put on notice that when he becomes Commissioner Edelblue is going to be really, he's going to be under great scrutiny by people in the public education, arena.
And there's one thing. I mean, Ella, there was really very little doubt that there was going to that he was not going to be confirmed.
Right.
You know, certainly there was a lot of emailing and calling of counselors, but from the moment that Governor Sununu announced that Edelblue was his pick, the Republicans on the council, who do have the majority, said very positive things about him.
Right. I mean, I think that Edelblue is certainly seen as somebody who is kind of an unconventional pick, maybe sort of Sununu, I think, is a little bit more centrist on this issue, and Edelblue is, I think, kind of seen as slightly more conservative. But they both, I think, share the view of more school choice, and what that sort of remains to be seen of how that's going to affect New Hampshire, how that's going to affect the state's public school system. You know, a lot of people that are against sort of opening up more money for charter schools and private schools say that that's going to drain more money from the state's, already underfunded public schools. But it's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, like you said, I think that, there was kind of no doubt that Edelblue was going to be confirmed because that Republicans hold the majority on the executive council.
Yeah, and I think as Jeff's comments suggested, this is a very big moment for school choice advocates. They've gone a number of years with a Democratic governor in New Hampshire, 8 years of a Democratic president. They feel like this is their time, homeschooling, religious secondary schools, charter school advocates. They feel like they've been on their heels for a number of years, and now both at the national level with Betsy DeVos, assuming she squeaks through, and here with Frank Edelblue at the state level, that they may finally make some progress. And, most of that debate really, had sort of an ideological flavor to it. It's kind of public school people who are concerned about public school funds being drained away to other non-public sources of education. This is sort of a debate that's been around for as long as I can remember. School choice vouchers. Yeah. It's just the choice folks feel like they're finally getting some advantage.
I have to say, as a backdrop to this, also is the very strong interest that's developed over the last decade, at least, in the business community, in the public school system, the K-12 system, in terms of developing it to improve skills, to improve the graduation rates, the quality of the student, the quality of the students are coming out of there. And it'll be interesting to see if the focus is somewhat taken off of the public school system, what that means to people in the business community. How are they going to respond to this? Because they've been working very hard in working with relationships, building relationships with high schools and even middle schools.
I mean, Edelblue, when he testified, he did say that, and he does have he was a successful entrepreneur. He ran a business that, his interest was in, increasing, kind of competency-based education and more partnerships with businesses. And he talked about how he considered, some of the work that the community tech colleges have done to be, sort of emblematic of things he would want to do. And so, we'll see what he actually does when he gets in there. But another backdrop to this is, Frank Edelblue's potential political ambition. Obviously, he only narrowly lost to Chris Sununu in the primaries, fewer than 1,000 votes. And it was, it was certainly a surprise to Governor Sununu that it was so close. And, Chris Pappas, counselor from Manchester, when he was questioning him, he noted that Frank Edelblue, his campaign website is still up, that, he asked him if he would, Volinsky asked him if he would commit to stay through his whole term, and Edelblue didn't really answer the question. It was delivered in kind of a compound question where you could kind of get off with not answering it. When Chris Pappas of Manchester asked Edelblue about would he be prepared to, step out of politics fully, forgo going to Republican political events, endorse candidates, Edelblue said, I can't say that. And, I thought that was interesting, and it was hard to know how telling it was. Maybe he was unprepared. Maybe the Sununu office didn't just say, you're out of politics when you do this. But it was a weird moment.
It would be highly unusual for a commissioner to stay involved in politics at that level.
I do think, in a sense, Edelblue is just sort of figuring out where he's going here. And here's someone who he didn't really know. He almost won the Republican nomination for governor, and now he's going to be a education commissioner. And so I think he's just trying to keep his options open and sort of figure out where he goes next.
All right, let's go to the phones. Barbara's on the line from Henniker. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to add to the discussion. I don't think you've talked about the vote that he took last year on the bill that was going to do away with treatment of homosexuals, that they have a problem, and that if we can just treat them, they'll be fine. Well, of course, that is not true. They have, yes, years ago they did say homosexuality was an illness, but they have long since decided it is not. And having people participate in these treatments can do a lot of damage. particularly kids. I mean,
so I recognize your voice. This is former Representative French. The bill you're talking about, would have forbidden so-called conversion therapy on minors.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right. And he voted the wrong way. He didn't. He voted to continue to have the centers. I mean, to have the treatment.
Yes, thank you for the call, Representative French. And that did come up during the confirmation hearing. And, you know, Frank Edelblue, and I haven't gone, like, pored over his testimony, but his explanation was that he was questioning the science that proponents of the bill were citing, and his claim was that the science, did not prove anything. But it is definitely true that Frank Edelblue is, you know, very conservative. One reason he did so well in the primaries, he sort of really built a coalition of conservative groups ranging from evangelical Christians to
gun rights activists
to educational choice. And, you know, something that also came up in the hearing was his role on the board of the foundation of Patrick Henry College, which is a college where officers of the college and students are supposed to adhere to a biblical worldview. And Counselor Valinsky asked him whether or not whether science teachers in the state should be concerned. And Edelblue said, you know, that's really not my job as commissioner, that would be, you know, a purview of school boards, basically.
Yeah, but I believe that the State Board of Education or the State Department of Education oversees curriculum development in schools. So, there is a conceivable way for that to be approached. I mean, I do know that I talk, because my wife was a public school teacher for many, many years, and I do know that people in the public education area are concerned about the incoming commissioner for either imagined or for actual reasons. One of the things he said in his hearing was he referred to public education as a product, as you know, using like a kind of a marketing term, because he's from the business world, and I think that did kind of raise hackles in that, saying that, well, it's a product like you know, soap.
Well, he also said that at one point he wanted public schools to be the choice. You know, it's hard to know how much of this is just, you know, sincerely the way he was articulating things, how much of it was kind of coded speech to appeal to people of a particular bent, and you know, on the flip side of that, would agitate people who, with a foot in the public school world. Yeah. And so, you know, we will see. The council will be voting on Frank Edelblue in 2 weeks, assuming that all things go according to plan. And as when the vote was delayed due to this procedural hiccup that was mentioned earlier, the Republicans on the council said they will be voting for him. So, barring the unforeseen, Frank Edelblue will be the state's next education commissioner, and I guess we will see what comes out of that. I want to turn to some of the bills that were pending at the State House this week. Ella, we saw another reminder that the tide is turning on marijuana a bit at the State House. You were covering a bill that would decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. What specifically would that bill do, and what struck you as notable about the hearing?
So the thing that I think was most notable about the hearing was, there was no law enforcement there, and they have typically been pretty vocal on, opposing decriminalization measures in the past. And then the other thing was that New Futures, which is a drug treatment prevention and recovery advocacy organization, was there, and they did not actively oppose the bill. They also made it very clear that, you know, they were not rising in support of the bill, but I think this is their advocacy director said that this, in fact, has been the first time that they're not actively opposing decriminalization. So that's certainly a big development. And I think the only organization that was there in opposition to the bill was somebody from the Catholic Archdiocese in Manchester. So this bill would decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. I think it's currently a misdemeanor. This would just bring it down to a violation. And this, of course, is for adults, not minor or juveniles possessing it. That's, you know, still carries more weight. But it just with Maine to the north and Massachusetts to the south recently, just outright voting in favor of recreational use of marijuana, I think that the tide has definitely turned. I think New Hampshire is the last state in New England to not decriminalize. So a lot of people are just saying, listen, we are way past the times, and this just doesn't make any sense.
And Governor Sununu has said he'd be game for decriminalization.
And legalization is now, it's legal, it can be legal in Maine and Massachusetts, and the attitudes are really changing. I mean, the one caveat is it's taken a long time to just roll out the medical marijuana program that was approved 3 years ago. So you wonder, kind of, decrim, I think, is a pretty easy thing for people to do, but actual legalization. And it reminded me how much times have changed with the Supreme Court nomination. People have been mentioning Douglas Ginsburg. Jeff, you probably remember Douglas Ginsburg, nominated to the Supreme Court in 87 by Ronald Reagan, had to withdraw his had to withdraw his nomination because of marijuana use. Shows you how things have changed.
Or President Clinton when he was running, and I never inhaled.
That used to be, you know, using marijuana used to be a kiss of death for a politician.
Exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones. George is on the line from Wolfboro. Good morning, George. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. If Mr. Edelblue is confirmed, do you think he'll be in favor of public money, taxpayer money, going to religious schools? And if so, would that be constitutional?
Thank you, George, for the question. You know, he's certainly in favor of more educational choice. You know, the Constitution in New Hampshire, you know, people can argue about what it says. It's obviously going to be up to the Supreme Court if it goes there. The Supreme Court has allowed the current sort of tax. You can get a credit against your business tax or deduction to contribute to a scholarship program. That they've let that stand, but they've never ruled on its actual constitutionality. They said the person who complained about it didn't have standing. So that's sort of an open question. And through the years, there have been efforts to go to a voucher system, and they haven't gone forward out of fears that they would not pass constitutional muster.
Yeah, exactly. And it is conceivable that with the makeup of the legislature right now, it could be pushed forward at some point.
And we're all going to be looking to see what's in Governor Sununu's budget on matters of education choice. He hasn't said. We're going to know in a week. But this is something that you know, his Waterville Valley actually did contribute to the tax, the educational tax program. So they did that. And so, you know, he's looking for more opportunities. I mean, soon to be Commissioner Edelblue did say several times during his hearing that he sees himself as the implementer of policy, and that policy is set by the Board of Education, local school boards, excuse me, and the legislature. And so the power of a Commissioner of Education is not vast.
No, but the commissioner, if he is involved, if he has kind of said, been a little wishy-washy about where he's going to be speaking, if he's going to be speaking out politically, it does raise questions. I can't remember any education commissioner going on to run for governor at some point either. I mean, I just think it's
some Board of Education chairman.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was another wrinkle during the hearing was that, you know, Councilor Valinsky was trying to say, well, somebody Mr. Elbalu's background might be, you know, more plausible as a Board of Education member than education commissioner. But, you know, Governor Sununu gets to pick, and Frank Edelblue is the guy he's picked. And so let's go to some emails. Bigotry, says Jack. The federal constitution forbids a religious test for offer, but apparently the religious beliefs of college, which the nominee for education commissioner is a board member, is fair game for opponents. Andrew Valinsky and others opposing the nomination are examples of bigotry on parade. Thank you, Jack. We have another email on the Edelblue nomination, which is, why is Edelblue against the Common Core? As a spouse of a school teacher, I'm wondering what Frank Edelblue has against the Common Core. I'm familiar with it. I have to say it's one of the most benign standards that have ever been enacted. This is from Sean. You know, Sean may say benign. You know, Republicans, you know, say something else. It's a red flag for them. Thank you for the emails. Stick around. We'll be back with the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup after the break. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Ellen Nilsen, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review. I want to turn to a bill that your paper covered, Jeff, and that's a bill to set up paid family medical leave, an insurance system in New Hampshire. You know, what would that bill do?
It's an interesting bill. It's this has been a priority of proponents for several sessions now, and it seems like this might actually be an opportunity this year. The governor has actually been, you know, kind of supportive of it, and actually on the national level, the president has voiced support for something like this. Now, for New Hampshire, it's interesting because right now there are three states that have these programs that are set up: California, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. They set it up, it's kind of like an unemployment trust fund type of thing, where money, a certain percentage is taken out of an employee's salary and goes into a trust fund. And then when they need to use it for some kind of family or medical leave, not just for, you know, not just for the birth of a child, but if like for an illness or their own illness, you know, to take care of a loved one, they can tap into this fund. New Hampshire's bill right now, which was basically carved out, basically was written to kind of assuage opponents, you know, people who maybe be critical of it, would at its creation would allow employees to opt out of it, so they wouldn't have to take part, but they could never go opt in again. Apparently, if you choose to opt out, so it would set up a fund only based on only using employees' money, and it would be a half of 1% of your salary each week, which I think is an average of about $250 a year from each employee. And then you'd set up this fund where employers, it's not going to affect employees don't have to contribute to it. It's not going to, and you'd get a certain, I think it may get up to 60% of your salary or something like
that.
And
that would be for 12 weeks.
For 12 week leave. They're still working on some of the details of it, also including whether, you know, you have to guarantee that someone could have their job back if you work for a small business. That kind of thing.
And would there be any carve-outs for businesses of a certain size? That's always an issue.
Well, actually, at this point, they haven't really worked on it that much. They would. I know that proponents want to keep it that everybody's covered. And right now, it's not quite clear where it's going. But right now, at the hearing the other day, it was very interesting because there was no outright opposition to this bill, including from the Lodging and Restaurant Association, which has been pretty vocal about it in the past. Their testimony raised some questions about it, especially about the size of the businesses. But when it came to anyone speaking out against it, there was hardly a peep from people. They're mostly just supporters, and I think these proponents see an opportunity for this to happen. It's an interesting experiment because some people are skeptical that it could actually work if you allow people to opt out of it, because, you know, obviously
talking about a pool.
Yeah, you're talking about, you know, a trust fund that, you know, a fund that needs as many people as possible. But right now it seems to be moving forward at a, you know, favorable rate. It's, you know, this is just the beginning. Just,
I mean,
the first,
you imagine,
hearing.
The intensity of scrutiny is going to grow.
Absolutely.
Should it get to the Senate?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but right now it's in committee, and it's, you know, there was no real outright, you know, criticism of the bill at this point.
Another bill that got a lot of attention this week, and one that has actually surprised people with its passage, was a bill that would change New Hampshire's time zone prospectively. We would join the Atlantic time zone, which is used by Canada's Atlantic provinces, much of the Caribbean, Bermuda, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, et cetera. You know, this legislation has an interesting origin story in that it springs from apparently a study in Massachusetts performed at the behest of Governor Charlie Baker. And that, the way the bill was drafted is that it would require Massachusetts to go first for New Hampshire to follow.
Yeah, well, imagine if Boston were, I mean, this really does away with daylight saving time in order to, you no longer would have to fall back, I believe. So you'd have more daylight in the afternoon rather than the early darkness. And, you know, imagine, I was talking to a couple of friends who were, you know, business people up here, and imagine if Boston were an hour off from New Hampshire. It would be very complicated from a, you know, financial work, et cetera, things like that. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, I think the turning the clocks back has become increasingly unpopular. People argue that it's outlived its usefulness. There's some studies that suggest that this sort of has negative health implications on people. So we're starting to hear more and more of this possibility of people, of states opting out, but it needs to be done in a way that kind of makes sense from a from a business perspective.
Yeah, one of the things I don't understand is why we have to wait for Massachusetts but not Maine, which is east of us.
Well,
so that'd be an hour later.
The bill is apparently pending in Maine and Rhode Island that would do the similar thing, but I would imagine it's tied to the
But Massachusetts
the economic,
is a big kahuna.
I guess, and like, you know, certainly the notion that New Hampshire needs to follow Massachusetts is something that, you rarely hear at the State House. I mean, I guess I've heard it. It certainly didn't work when in the context of expanded gambling.
Or income tax.
It may yet work on marijuana, but I mean, this is one that is interesting. And I guess we'll see where this goes in the Senate. Again, this bill was tabled. Were you in the House when they were voting on this, Ellen?
I was not.
Okay,
no.
So because there was an effort to table the bill, it fell a few votes shy, and then it went through on a voice vote. And, you know, I haven't paid close enough attention to know whether people are kind of like, okay, whatever. Sometimes that happens in the House. They just kind of shovel something across the hall. And I know I was in the hearing room when this passed, and I know that a lobbyist from the ski industry, came in and he had a piece of paper, and he's like, I can't believe they passed this, and was pondering the implications of what it might mean for an industry like the ski industry. I mean, he wasn't saying he was against it, but he was taken by surprise. I mean,
it's funny because you have to really use some kind of part of your brain that you don't usually have to use in terms of calculating times and what that would mean. What would this mean economically for the state? Seriously, in terms of the tourism industry and other things, it's not just a simple thing of making it easier for people not to have to turn their clocks back.
All right, I've got an email here from Nathan of Cornish. He said, I can't disagree more with your descriptions of Senators Hassan and Shaheen as being strong opposition to the Trump regime. I'm glad they opposed DeVos, but at this point, they have voted in favor of every cabinet pick so far. That's actually not true. But his bottom line is that I fully expect them to be among the squishes who will vote to break the filibuster of Gorsuch and then pretend to oppose it by voting no when it no longer matters. We need more from them. That's Nathan. That's an interesting point. Some factual issues there, but it does speak to the MO of Democrats at the moment, that there is, the base of the Democratic Party is very, ready to fight with Trump. And for those who got elected, obviously, Maggie Hassan got elected saying, well, I'm going to work with him when I can. And obviously that's what you're going to say. And I guess that's what you're going to do. But they've been pretty out there.
Yeah, but I think this has been a debate, a discussion going on for the last since November 8th, but among Democrats about how they're going to respond to this. And then I really do think that basically millions of people who marched on and rallied in on January 21st, I think has sent a signal to people like our two senators, that they really are going to have to pay attention to this base. And that's why I really believe when you read Senator Shaheen's statement about Gorsuch, and that's was pretty strong for her. I mean, and I think that if you put it in context, she is looks to me like she's listening, at least on this nominee.
And this dynamic's going on at the State House, and I know you wrote this week, Ella, about Democrats at the State House and what they want. And I mean, do you think we're talking about parallels here in terms of how Democrats at the State House are kind of trying to calibrate their opposition to Republicans being in charge?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the State House, they're sort of talking about, especially with bills like Right to Work and the concealed carry license repeal, that the Democratic leaders are kind of talking about this as a far right takeover of the Republican Party and sort of these far right things, that they said, Republican senators used to be opposed to these bills, years ago, and now outside influence is coming in and sort of turning things more conservative. But I think on the Democratic side, it's going to be really interesting to see sort of what, Trump does in terms of the parties kind of organizing at a grassroots level. I mean, this is kind of more nationally, but I've been hearing, and reading articles about Democrats kind of doing this Tea Party style takeover of town halls from U.S. senators and representatives. Especially when it comes to a potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act and just people coming and really making their opposition known. And it was interesting. We had some state leaders from the Democratic Party in for an editorial board at the Monitor this week. And Jeff Woodburn, who's the Senate Minority Leader, was sort of talking about how he thinks that the Democratic Party and, as you sort of put it, the smart people in the Democratic Party got it wrong in 2016 and said, I think we need to appeal to our progressive part of our party more.
Yeah, he has an op-ed. I know it ran an out paper. I think in others as well, where he does lay that out and said, we have to listen to the working people, and we have to really focus on that and not,
as the
highfalutin stuff.
As the debate to determine who's going to be the next Democratic Party, the national DNC chair goes on. I mean, New Hampshire's chairman Ray Buckley is in the thick of that, and there was an interesting quote from one of the forums that the DNC has been having to choose a leader when the question was asked about working with President Trump, and he said something to the effect of, you know, that's a ridiculous question. Like, of course not, basically. And so, it's going to be interesting to see. And, you know, Councillor Walensky, after his efforts to, take it to Frank Edelblue and then the procedural issue he raised, he was asked by a reporter, you know, are you trying to send a message? And he said no, but it is clear that Democrats are looking for ways to, you know, channel the kind of whirlwind of mobilization that has come.
You've seen that at the national level, where senators are on committees are just not going, showing up to vote to move nominations forward. The things that you haven't seen before or haven't seen in a long, long time. And I think the Democratic Party, because of what happened on November 8th, has really is in a state of flux right now. It's interesting to see how this all shakes out. And actually, that vote for the DNC chair is going to be very telling.
The Republican Party is sort of in flux too.
They've been in flux for a while,
and certainly President Trump and you know, at the state level, the Republicans had their annual meeting over the weekend. I attended. They elected former state senator Jeanie Forrester to be the next chairman of the party, and it is interesting to see, in terms of, like, you know, shakeout of the Republican gubernatorial primary. Frank Edelblue was always focused on the issues and never really went at Governor Sununu much. I mean, certainly Jeanie Forrester was, really after him at several points in that race, not to much effect with voters. Yeah. But she was Governor Sununu's pick to be chair. And, you know, one of the more interesting things that happened was that the parties decided to vote to allow compensation of the chair. And why don't we listen to a little bit of tape from that?
We didn't win any of our congressional seats, and we didn't win, as the president in New Hampshire, we didn't win our Senate seat. So those are very big shortcomings, and we need a whole lot more money if we're going to compete on the national level for these seats.
All right, that was Steve Stepanek, who is one of the state co-chairmen for Trump, and he was one of the people who, during the floor debate on paying the party chair, which has been a spirited debate for, you know, several years now, and it needed to get a supermajority in order to take place, and it did. And a lot of people were like, you know, we need to compete with Democrats because Ray Buckley, who is the chairman of the Democratic Party, has been receiving compensation from, I believe, back from starting in 2009.
Yeah, and Forrester is saying now is going to make New Hampshire red again. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on those congressional seats that are all Democratic. Certainly there was a belief that they need to have a professionalized staff in order to compete. On the Democrats, there's tremendous anger among progressives who feel like Mitch McConnell and particularly the Republican Senate obstructed President Obama for many years. The Merrick Garland block, which I've said many times, is just not in the Constitution to do something like that, has really angered them. And so they're looking for a little bit of, I think, punitive payback. I'm not sure exactly what the form is going to be. The problem is they don't have a majority in the Senate. As Jeff mentioned, they've stopped showing up at some of these confirmation hearings, and then the Republicans just suspend the rules and report out the candidates anyway. So I think the longer-term issue is going to be the future of the party. I think that you're right that the debate over who's going to chair the party is going to tell us a lot about where the party is headed. But I think the biggest challenge for Democrats is there's all this kind of energy out there, all the protests. How do you harness that in a way that is going to, rather than simply lead to larger margins in places like New York and California, harness it to change the outcome of the Electoral College in the Midwest? And that's going to be a big challenge.
But I mean, you look at here in New Hampshire, and it is interesting because certainly Democrats came out of the election feeling rather dispirited that, the Democratic candidate did not win for president. And that they didn't make bigger gains at the state house. They did make some gains in the House. Things held steady in the Senate. They swept the congressional races, and that was. And at the Republican meeting, while they were debating the payment of the chair, somebody yelled as somebody was advocating for this. But we won, and you know, as Steve Stepanek pointed out, well, you know, they won and they didn't win. I mean, it was sort of a muddle out of New Hampshire. And so It remains to be seen what happens. But certainly organizationally, locally, Democrats have been superior for some time.
Yeah, and also, you have to look at how many Democrats have been – how long the Democrats have held the governor's seat in, in the last 18 years? It's been, what, only – this is only the second.
And one of the things Ray Buckley is talking about, pitching himself as chairman, is, three out of the last four U.S. Senate races, 11 out of 13 for Congress, 5 out of 6 for governor, whatever. But still, Republicans, it's interesting because, Republicans at the State House, they're feeling, and we'll see what happens when the budget is presented next week, but I was working a little preview piece about that, and you're talking to a lot of Republicans, and typically it's like the governor hands in the budget, and it's like, oh, thanks a lot, nice work, we're going to do ours now. The degree to which whether or not they're going to be more on the same page, and at least right now they're talking as if they are. Like, we'll see. It's a long budget season, as we all know.
But I have to say, on the flip side of what Ray Buckley is saying, is that they also had not had control of the House and the Senate for many years, and while he's been chairman, so of the New Hampshire House and Senate. So.
Fair enough. So okay, we're almost out of time. What's everyone going to be up to next week, Ella?
Well, we've been working on a story with all of the outcries about what Trump has been doing with executive orders. We've been talking to supporters who so far seem pretty happy with the new president. So
is that going to be in the paper Sunday?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jeff?
Well, I know next week we'll be looking at see what the governor's budget's going to be. That's a big deal. And we'll hear what he's framing. This will really show what direction his administration into.
Dean?
Yeah, we same thing. We've noted a number of times that Governor Sununu has been fairly general so far. Yeah. It's going to be good to finally see what's in that budget, and it'll give us a much better sense of where he's headed over the next 2 years.
Agreed. Thanks for joining us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Thanks to the guests, Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, Ella Nelson, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.